U.S. Legal Support is a proud sponsor of the Legal Face-Off podcast. With over 85 locations around the country and one of the leading providers of litigation services, U.S. Legal Support is the only litigation support company that not only provides a full suite of court reporting solutions to major insurance companies, corporations, and law firms nationwide, they also provide their clients with record retrieval, interpreting and translations, trial services, and transcription services. You can always count on U.S. Legal Support to provide reliable and efficient litigation support services. Visit uslegalsupport.com to find out more.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have.
WGN. And joining us first is Ellie Hanning from CNN. You could look at Cross-Exam Weekly on CNN, and he's also a former federal prosecutor, and he's here with us in the Legal Face Off.
Hey, Ellie, thanks for joining us. Lots of new evidence coming in regarding Trump's impeachment inquiry. It seems to be piling up every day. As a former federal prosecutor, you're, of course, used to triaging new evidence. What do you think is the two or three pieces of evidence that is most damning against the president right now?
Thanks for having me, first of all. So I would start any presentation of evidence with the call itself, the July 25th call. Now, we don't have audio of that call. We have what people call the summary transcript. But look, that's the president's own words to President Zelensky, and I think it's quite damning to Donald Trump. If you follow the sequence of the call, the president, Trump, first of all, says, we've given you a lot of help, Ukraine. It's not reciprocal. And then the Ukrainian president sort of talks about the importance of the foreign aid that we've been sending. And then Trump says his famous line, I would like you to do us a favor, though, and then lays out, I'd like you to look into this CrowdStrike thing, this sort of theory about the DNC server and the Bidens. And then the president says, and I'll have Rudy Giuliani and my attorney general get in touch with you. I would start with that. I think the second piece of evidence I would use would be the texts. There was all these texts between Bill Taylor, Rudy Giuliani, Gordon Sondland, all these State Department and diplomatic insiders, plus Rudy, who's not an insider. But where you see them in real time, these people who are career diplomatic professionals worrying out loud in writing, wait a second, are we holding up military aid here in order to get investigations of political opponents? I think that's pretty damaging. And then I think the third layer would be the witness testimony. We've now seen testimony from over a dozen witnesses, but in particular, I think Bill Taylor and Alexander Vindman, who testified last week, paint a really sort of damaging picture of what was going on there.
So, Ali, President Trump is clearly trying to turn the tables on his accusers and blame Democrats, Hunter Biden, the witnesses, the whistleblower, pretty much anyone and everyone. What does this say about the state of mind of the president, and how do prosecutors look at efforts like these by a defendant?
Well, it's Donald Trump's sort of core theory that he took from his mentor, Roy Cohn, which is deny everything and counterattack, right? Admit nothing, deny everything, and launch counterattack. And we see him doing that here. Look, it's the kind of thing I dealt with as a prosecutor. The stronger the evidence you had on a defendant, the more likely they were to lash out at everybody and everything else. And it becomes a battle between distraction and focus. And as a prosecutor, I can't tell you how many times I said to a jury, keep focused on the evidence here. This case is not about the prosecution. It's not about the cops. It's not about some irrelevant issue. It's about this defendant, the charges against him, and the evidence. Now, that said, perhaps it is an effective way to at least keep his base intact, because this is not a criminal trial. This is not a jury of 12 neutral citizens who will make up their minds based on the strength of the evidence. Ultimately, all President Trump needs to do is hold intact the firewall of the Senate Republicans. And as long as he doesn't lose 20 of them, he will get through this. And so I think just giving them something else to point at, some distraction, some talking point, may give them enough so that they stay on board.
You mentioned Alexander Vindman's testimony last week, who was, you know, he showed up in full dress, military uniform, and certainly visually had an impact. Of course, Trump, as Tina mentioned, and all of his surrogates came out and attacked him as being a never-Trumper. Substantively, though, and legally, does it really matter what Vindman says? I mean, does it matter that he heard the president talk on the phone with the Ukrainian president? As long as we have the transcript, what's the difference between
the transcript and what Weidman says, aside from the aesthetics and the look of someone actually testifying about firsthand knowledge.
Yeah, it matters to an extent. So I agree with you that it does not matter how other people characterize what's being said on the phone call, except to the extent that they might be able to add flavor or explain what a certain phrase means. But by and large, I think we're putting too much emphasis on this witness said he thought it was legal. This witness said he thought it was illegal. Ultimately, it's not up to the witnesses to characterize or tell us whether the words that were said are legal or illegal or even impeachable or not impeachable. That said, Vindman did have other very relevant testimony. He was able to bring to life sort of what was going on behind the scenes, in particular the fact that this, people call it shadow foreign diplomacy, but foreign diplomacy is even giving it too much credit. Just this shadow group of Rudy and Sondland and Rick Perry were really given the reins on this very important issue, and the pros, the people like Bill Taylor and Vindman and the Ambassador Ivanovich, were pushed aside. And you have to ask, why was that done? Why were Rudy and Sondland put in charge? And when you look at all the evidence, all they wanted, they had one and only one policy goal, which is get Ukraine to investigate the Bidens and the DNC. That's it. They were not at all looking out for our United States foreign policy interests. They were not looking at the global scale. All they wanted was to get these, what they called the deliverables, in hand for the president. And that, I think, is relevant, and that's something that Vindman's testimony goes to.
So when do you think we will see articles of impeachment, and do you have any sense as to how many there will be?
So timing-wise, I think the House Democrats understand that they are really under time pressure here. The longer this drags out, the more it will seem political, the more the public's attention will sort of fade. I think best-case scenario right now, the House considers and votes on articles of impeachment before Christmas, and then the trial happens in January and February. Incidentally, that was almost the exact same time frame that we had in the Bill Clinton case in 98 into 99. So I think we will see an impeachment trial in the Senate in early 2020. What was the second part of your question? I'm sorry.
Do you have any prediction on how many there will be?
Oh, how many articles of impeachment? Yeah, so this is an important tactical decision that House Democrats need to make. I guess there's one school of thought of throw everything in there, Ukraine and Mueller and obstruction of justice and abuse of power. But I think there's another school of thought which I tend towards, which is keep it clean, keep it tight. So if I was advising Adam Schiff or Jerry Nadler or Nancy Pelosi or whoever, I would say, look, you bring one article of impeachment for abuse of power in relation to Ukraine. Maybe you bring separate articles of impeachment for some of the crimes that potentially were committed, bribery, extortion, receipt of foreign election aid, and then maybe you bring one more article for obstruction of Congress for the White House sort of stonewalling and telling all of its people to ignore the subpoenas. But anything beyond that, I think, gets too complex, both for your jury, meaning the Senate, and for the American public.
Thank you so much. These are definitely hot topics that we are going to be touching, especially since there are more and more dinners approaching. And if we want to find more information for you, it's on Lowenstein.com.
Lowenstein.com, CNN.com, Twitter, you name it.
And that is Lowenstein.com. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks very much.
Rich Lenkoff is an insurance defense attorney with Bryce Downey & Lenkoff. Rich is consistently recognized by clients for his outstanding litigation results. In 2015, Target named him their top outside litigation attorney in the country. Rich has received a number of industry accolades, including Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 through 2018 and Leading Lawyer from 2012 through 2018, designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, including serving on the Lincoln Park High School Local School Council, the Advisory Board of Legal Prep Charter Academy, and the Board of Visitors for the Northern Illinois University College of Law. In addition to his full-time legal practice, Rich is a producer with credits, including 85, the greatest team in football history, starring former President Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka, and Renegades, a live show production at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon. In addition to co-hosting Legal Faceoff since 2013, Rich is the legal analyst for several WGN shows, including The Bill and Wendy Show. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional liability, business transactions, construction law, and intellectual property. For more information about Rich and Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, please visit bdlfirm.com.
We are continuing with the hot topics, and now we have Dr. Marianne Franks. She is a professor of law at the University of Miami School of Law. Her areas of expertise include First Amendment law, Second Amendment law, privacy, cyber law, and criminal law, as well as procedure. Welcome to Legal Face-Off.
Thanks very much for having me.
So, Marianne, last week, California Democratic Representative Katie Hill resigned from her seat in the wake of a House Ethics Committee announcement that it was going to open an investigation into allegations that Hill was involved in an inappropriate relationship with one of her subordinates. Hill's estranged husband is at the center of what has become a revenge porn scandal. Can you fill in our listeners on what happened?
Well, so what we know so far is that the allegations are that the husband here in this case released some intimate photos, and according to Katie Hill, these are actually photos that were created without consent as well as distributed without consent. And what we know is that these photos ended up on a right-wing blog called Red State, and then many of them were reprinted on the Daily Mail. And in the wake of this, of course, the revelations were made about her relationship with this campaign staffer, which in itself does not violate any laws and it would not violate House rules. But there led to another allegation of a different relationship with a congressional staffer, which, if true, would in fact violate House rules. And so within the midst of all of those rumors and allegations going around, what seemed clear is that someone certainly has invaded Katie Hill's privacy in a way that is unethical, certainly, and illegal in several states.
46 states, to your point, and the District of Columbia have made it illegal to release revenge porn or use it in some fashion. There is no law currently at the federal level, although there is legislation. It hasn't made it very far. Talk to us about what revenge porn is, and update us if you can on the efforts to fix this issue at the federal level, and whether you think this latest resignation from Katie Hill will advance that goal.
Certainly. So let's start with the term revenge porn. That's part of the problem in some ways when we're trying to think about the public understanding of what happened here and also the legal understandings of what happened here. The better term for it that most advocates use is non-consensual pornography. And the reason why we make that distinction is because this kind of invasion of privacy can happen for a multitude of motives. People might do it because they are angry and embittered at an ex-partner, or they might do it for political gain, or they might do it for profit or for entertainment. And one of the reasons why we really need a federal criminal bill on this matter is because of the 46 states that have laws, they tend to define the crime very differently. And many of those state laws require a very specific motive on the part of the perpetrator, namely one that involves intending to harass or to hurt the victim. And so what that means is if you are a perpetrator who engaged in this kind of behavior for profit or entertainment or personal gain, then you would be off the hook. What the federal law would do is define the crime properly as an invasion of privacy and treat it like other forms of invasions of privacy and set out the elements as simply the fact that the material is private, that it's sensitive, and that it's disclosed without consent. And that's exactly what the federal bill, the SHIELD Act, is intended to do, and also to clarify some of the jurisdictional problems that victims might face, as we saw in this particular case. When you have these kinds of abuses that are often perpetrated through the internet, it raises questions about which state law should apply. If we have a federal law in place, that makes the question a lot easier.
Marianne, you've stated that women are more likely to be targeted by revenge porn than men, and LGBTQ women in particular. Can you please explain why that is and what you think is the longer term impact of that issue?
Well, what we know empirically is that there is a real gender disparity when it comes to the targeting of people by non-consensual pornography. There is, according to the study that the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative did in 2017, women are 1.7 times more likely to be targeted than men are, and LGB individuals are 7 times as likely to be targeted than the population that identifies as straight. Now, we can draw a number of hypotheses about why that's the case. One of them that seems pretty clear is that we have a society that very much indulges its desire to objectify women without consent, that there is a market for the sexual objectification of women without their consent in a way that there isn't for men, and that we've seen this particular kind of invasion of privacy or sexual entertainment being used against women who are in positions of power or who are seeking positions of power. And the Katie Hill story seems to be another example of that. When it comes to why it would be the case that members of sexual minorities would be also targeted, could be because they defy certain forms of conventional norms around sexuality, that they defy certain stereotypes about how we think, how mainstream society thinks people should behave. But a lot of this seems to go back to misogyny and some sort of very deep sort of backwards norms and moral judgments about people's sexual behavior and identity.
Doctor, understandably, victims of this type of tactic just want to get generally the images and material off of the internet. You're doing some excellent work with the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative that you just mentioned. What are some ways that you and this organization work with victims to help them in these situations?
Well, one of the things we try to say at the outset for victims is to ensure that they understand that this is not their fault. Unfortunately, every time there is a high-profile case like Katie Hill's, in addition to all the support that she might get, you also see an extraordinary amount of victim blaming. A lot of high-profile people who will say some very, very ignorant things about who's responsible for what happened. So the primary thing we try to do is to assure victims that they've done nothing wrong and they have nothing to be ashamed of. And then from there, we try to figure out what each individual victim thinks is most important for him or her. That is, for a lot of them, as you say, it's going to be, how can I get these pictures taken down? For others, it's also going to be, can I do something that will get me a sense of justice over what has happened? And if we are talking about victims who have had to go into therapy or who have had to move or who have been kicked out of their homes or have lost their jobs, are there ways that we can think about how they could recover some of the expenses associated from becoming a target of this abuse? And what we often have to tell victims, unfortunately, is that there's a very counterintuitive impulse that we have to urge, which is try not to get stuff taken down too easily or too readily, because if you are trying to build a case against the person who has done this to you, you're going to need to preserve a lot of that as evidence. But one of the things we provide on our website is a how-to guide in terms of requesting that certain material be taken down from various social media platforms and also to be taken out of Google search engine results.
Dr. Well, like we said, you're doing great work with the CCRI. And just on a different note, it must be a great Monday there at the University of Miami, having put a wallop on your arch rival Florida State, so much so that you got their coach fired. That's got to be a great day at the U today, right?
It's a pretty good day.
Thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off. Please come back and update us on this very important topic.
Doctor, and if people want to contact you, what's the best way to do that?
They can contact me through Twitter at MA_Franks, or they can contact me through email. That's marianne.franks@gmail.com.
In addition, people can visit cybercivilrights.org. That is cybercivilrights.org.
Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
We all know the legal world is complex and high-pressured. There's no room for error. That's why judges and attorneys across Chicagoland have trusted the expert court reporters at McCorkle Litigation Services since 1948. McCorkle Litigation Services has accurately recorded every word from thousands of legal proceedings. McCorkle Litigation Services provides the legal community with peace of mind, transcribing testimony and depositions that can be used reliably by jurors, judges, and attorneys. For all of your legal support needs, contact McCorkle Litigation Services online at McCorkleLitigation.com.
And moving on to our next guest at this time, it's Professor Daniel Blinka. He's a professor that teaches courses in evidence, trial practices, criminal law, and constitutional criminal procedure. He also is a director of the Law School Certificate of Litigation Program. And we have him here at Legal Face-Off because we want to discuss the cruise ship death case.
Professor, thanks so much for joining us. Last week, Salmonella was charged with negligent homicide after dropping his granddaughter out of an 11-story window on a Royal Caribbean cruise last July. Explain to us first, if you can, what negligent homicide is.
Well, negligent homicide is different from intentional homicide, murder, where one intentionally kills another human being. This involves an unreasonable risk of substantial harm or death. Put differently, it's the kind of behavior that a reasonable person would not engage in.
So why do you think that the prosecutors decided to go this route of charging this lesser charge against the grandfather rather than intentional homicide?
Well, without knowing, too much about whatever evidence the prosecution has, it doesn't seem as though this is a situation where grandfather deliberately killed his granddaughter. More likely, I would think this is a tragedy, a grandfather horse playing with his granddaughter, and it just all went very, very wrong. As you summed up the charges, he dropped his granddaughter 11 stories from wherever he was perched down to the deck where she died.
Prosecutors are in essence saying that we accept that you did not know about the class. Certainly they don't think that this grandfather intended to drop his granddaughter out of the 11-story glass, and they accept that he didn't know about the class. But in essence, they're saying that any reasonable person in his situation would have acted differently. They would have put their hands through it to determine if there was glass. They would have checked. They would have been aware of the risk that holding up a child is dangerous. I know that when this first happened, part of his answer was that, this child really enjoyed banging on glasses and they had done this before. But they are hoping, in essence, that a jury will agree with the prosecution that this was just simply not reasonable, no matter what this individual might have thought. So can you explain to our listeners the difference between this reasonable person standard and what the individual's intent really, really is?
Well, essentially, the reasonable person here would be the reasonable, grandfather. Does a reasonable grandfather play with his grandchildren? Absolutely. Does a reasonable grandfather put his grandchild in this kind of peril? That is to say, dangling 11 stories above the deck? And I think the answer is no. So with a negligent homicide charge, the prosecutor essentially doesn't have to go into his head to prove what he knew or to prove what he intended. They simply have to make the case to the jury that no reasonable person would have subjected the child to this risk of death. The other thing that I wonder about, and just because we don't have access to the evidence, is of course the prosecution is aware that this is an enormously sympathetic defendant, a grandfather who killed his own granddaughter. One suspects that maybe they have reason to believe that he's not being completely truthful or candid with him. What we don't know is whether his story has changed over time, whether they're trying to shift blame to the cruise line, if only to take it off of the grandfather. But the point is that we can all have empathy for the grandfather, but once we conclude that he isn't being completely honest with us about what happened here, then we become much less sympathetic. And it may very well be that's how the prosecution is going to present this case to the jury.
Professor, this case is in some ways very similar to the hot car deaths that we have seen rise steadily over the last few years in which we have covered on this show. To your point about not really knowing exactly where the grandfather is right now in terms of how truthful he is being and so forth, can you explain the difficult decisions that prosecutors have to make in deciding whether to charge a caregiver, as it really makes the initial tragedy all the much more difficult, particularly if there isn't a situation here where the grandfather acted irresponsibly or intentionally?
Well, as we mentioned earlier, this is he's going to evoke enormous sympathy just by being the grandparent who, regardless of how this case turns out, this man has got to live with this for the rest of for the rest of his life. For the prosecutor, though, they've got a responsibility to enforce the law, and for whatever motive he may have acted upon, he killed this young defenseless child. And the problem for the prosecution is, where's your evidence? I don't know whether or not they've got closed circuit TV that may have, recorded the tragedy. We don't know about other witnesses. The victim is not only very young, but she's now also dead, and so her voice will never be heard in the courtroom. So essentially, the strongest evidence for the prosecution is the defendant's statement. And that's why I think that it may very well be that there have been some shifting of the story over time, and the prosecutors aren't convinced that Grandpa is being completely candid. But this will be an enormously difficult case to try, not because the legal issues are particularly tough, but because of the sympathy that he will engender, especially since it appears that the family is standing in support of him.
Professor, you've worked on a lot of high-profile cases over the years. Among those cases are ones involving Jeffrey Dahmer, former Green Bay Packers tight end Mark Chmura. So you're no stranger to high-profile cases. How much do you think prosecutors take into account when dealing with high-profile cases the likelihood of winning? Obviously, every prosecutor wants to win, and they don't bring cases that they don't think they have the evidence to support. In this case, to your point, there's going to be a huge sympathy factor for the jury. Do you think the prosecutors made that decision in terms of how likely they are to win in bringing charges? Or do you think it's equally persuasive to them to send the message that they're going to at least prosecute these cases? Maybe they won't win, but there is something to be gained from the public knowing that prosecutors will at least charge people in these situations.
Well, I think your last point is very well taken here, that, their duty is to, enforce the law. And where you have a young child who dies in this manner, if there's evidence to support the prosecution, no matter how sympathetic, the defendant, might be, they've got a responsibility to go forward. I would expect that a seasoned prosecutor in a case like this will confront the sympathy factor head on from the very first moment when the jury panel is brought in, looking to see whether there is anyone on that panel who would just as soon not sit and make a difficult decision in a case like in a case like this one. But there are many reasons for bringing tough cases, and if the prosecutor feels that they've got enough to convict, then ethically, legally, that is what's required here.
Thank you so much, Professor Daniel Blinka, for helping us see a more clear picture on this cruise ship death case. If people want to see or find out more about you, where can they see that?
They can visit the Marquette University Law School website.
Thanks, Professor. We really appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubble and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers and Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Now we have some in-studio guests and legal face-off, and we're going to start off with Dr. Amy Mahan with McDermott, Will & Emery, and we also have Mark Herlinski, editor of Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. So we want to start off on one of the hot topics, and that has to do with Trump losing his tax return case.
Yeah, breaking news today, an appellate court in New York decided that Trump has to release his taxes. He is being the records were subpoenaed in the cases involving his, shall we call them what, paramours?
Friends.
Friends. Karen McDougal, the former Playboy model, and Stormy Daniels, former porn star, have subpoenaed these records as part of the – well, I should say the New York's attorney general has subpoenaed them as part of the ongoing investigation into cases involving reimbursements by the Trump Organization and Michael Cohen into the cases involving these two. So he, of course, initially lost – and was ordered to produce them at the federal level, and his attorneys appealed them to the Second Circuit. And again, today they announced that he has to turn them over. Trump's lawyer has, of course, predictably said that we will continue to fight this issue, take it up to the Supreme Court. And what's interesting is the court said that basically Trump's not above the law in having to turn over these tax returns. Now, they were careful in the language limiting this to only the issue involving the records. They said the only question before us is whether a state may lawfully demand production by a third party of the president's personal financial records for use in a grand jury investigation while the president is in office. That language is important because Trump has basically said famously that I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and not be prosecuted. His overall legal strategy is, as the sitting president, everything is executive privilege. Everything is off limits, which in this case, the court has said for this specific issue, that's not the case. It was instructive to hear the judges referencing this Fifth Avenue argument in oral arguments last week. And they said, do you mean to say that if the president shot someone on Fifth Avenue, he cannot be prosecuted? I think it's important to remember that when Trump said that, he was referring to the political repercussions, not really the legal repercussions. He was basically saying that I could do anything I want and I'll still have this, you know, base. But at least in terms of this particular issue, he lost. Whether the Supreme Court will take it up is an interesting question. I think they will, because it really is the type of issue that the Supremes like to take and is really one of first impression. But big loss for the president today. Tina?
I agree. It'll be interesting to see if the Supreme Court takes it up, given the political winds blowing within the Supreme Court. I do think that the point you raise is an excellent one about the really fine line and distinction that the court is making here. I think they made the right call. I guess the question is, let's assume for the moment that the Supreme Court doesn't take this up. The question in my mind becomes, how does this play out? I mean, obviously, part of it depends on whether he's still in office after the next election and obviously a number of other things. But it'll be interesting to see how this one plays out.
Mark, what do you think the Supremes will do with this case? Obviously, the Law Bulletin covers the Supreme Court frequently, especially given the fact that two of the justices that will hear this case, if it makes it that far, were appointed by the president and fall in the 5-4 majority, which is currently the conservative majority.
It's going to be interesting because there's an ongoing debate that exists long before Trump even took office about where that fine line of executive power ends. And if you remember back from the confirmation hearings from both justices before the Senate, there were discussions about where they buy into the executive power, whether there is truly oversight power by Congress and where that goes. To hear from the president and his legal team right now, they're kind of using an interesting thing where in the actual courtroom proceedings, and this one doesn't even directly invoke Trump. This is directly between prosecutors and an accounting firm. It's sort of tangential to him. But they're essentially saying that the court has no place to investigate the president, that the only remedy to that is impeachment by the legislative branch, a co-equal branch. Then you have on another front, as we know this week, plenty of happenings on Capitol Hill involving impeachment proceedings, and the president's team in that angle is saying, hey, this is improper process, it's not being fair. So they're sort of having it both ways if you look at it that way. And you know, they're not necessarily going to get held to the political arguments in court. They have the law there, but between the efforts by Congress to get those tax returns and the efforts through the New York State Attorney General and this district attorney out of Manhattan, this information is going to get out. So
it's also interesting timing because the other day Trump tweeted that he is moving to Florida when he's out of the White House, and he's going to not live in New York anymore. And many people saw that as an effort to dodge this whole tax issue. Amy, you're a voter. Forever, presidents have released their tax returns as a matter of course. There's no law mandating it until now, maybe, but it's traditionally something that people running for office would do in an effort to show transparency. Trump has now established, at least for the time being, that you don't have to do that and you could still win. As a voter, do you think it's important to see this kind of information, or do you think you agree with Trump that this is not something you need to know? It's really none of your business.
I think as a voter, yeah, definitely. For me, I think that having that information, and I think looking at his behavior to avoid at all costs disclosing that information despite multiple opportunities to comply, to release them and come clean with whatever he is hiding, it strikes me as evasive behavior that there is something in his tax returns that he is hiding and doesn't want the public to see.
Yeah, it's a great point. We just had Eli Honing on, who's a former federal prosecutor. We have federal prosecutors on all the time. They'll always tell you that the more you try to withhold evidence, the stronger evidence that is of your guilt, your self-conscious of guilt. So I think that's a great point.
We will continue on with the next hot topic, and that happens to be Alexa. You know, this is very interesting because technology is playing part in many cases now, and maybe Alexa is going to be a star witness now?
Well, I guess we're going to have to see. I mean, this is a very interesting case. We've seen similar cases involving iPhones and the use of information on iPhones in the context of investigations. In this instance, there was a murder involving a man and his girlfriend. She actually died after suffering a stab wound to the chest. And police in Florida are trying to figure out what exactly happened. And they are looking to use recordings that were made through Echo, which ends up hooking up to Alexa, for those of you who are not familiar with the Amazon Echo, and the belief that there may be recordings of what actually transpired between the couple. Now, what's interesting here is that the boyfriend is claiming that they had an argument and that it was in the context of trying to pull his girlfriend off the bed that she ended up being impaled by
a spear.
And one has to ask oneself, why do you have a spear in your house, let alone at the foot of your bed?
Happens to me all the time in my bedroom. I impale someone in the chest with a spear.
So the thinking is that
pointed business side up.
The thinking is that the Echo may have recorded what transpired, but what's interesting is that assumes that either Alexa was spoken or some other prompt to activate the Echo was spoken for purposes of starting the recording. Now, Amazon has said that they typically do not disclose this kind of information, which they consider customer information, unless there is a demand to do so, and they need to abide by a legally valid order.
Yeah, bigger picture here, obviously, is we're all concerned about privacy in the age of Siri and Echo and Amazon and all this stuff. At what point does your personal information remain personal versus being subject to subpoenas and other people looking? And I think the obvious answer is when there's a spear in someone's chest, right? I mean, you do want that evidence when it can be relevant to a crime like murder. Amazon, to their credit, has complied in the past with in a similar situation. But yeah, I mean, I think reasonable minds would agree that there is a limit as to what you should be getting from Amazon, from Siri, all these other similar things. What do you guys think?
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think I've seen three murder cases relating to maybe there's information on an Alexa or an Echo or something like that. In most of those cases, the defendant has actually requested the information released. And so there hasn't really been the same sort of privacy issue.
Well, in this case, his attorney says he thinks it's going to exonerate his client. So
yeah. But, you know, presumably these things are going to happen again, and there's going to be a situation where multiple situations where the defendant doesn't want the recordings released. And then this is kind of a new technology area, whether or not we have, I mean, the standard, the decades old standard is a reasonable expectation of privacy. If it's something like your home, you need where you have a reasonable expectation of privacy, then police officer needs a warrant, needs to go through the proper channels to access that data. We know that Alexa is recording all of this information, and we're not using one of the ways to stop that data collection that Amazon has published. You can physically stop recording, or you can do something online to uncheck record. Where does that reasonable expectation of privacy stop with this type of technology?
Sure. Mark, are you suspicious that your conversations are being recorded by the various devices in your house?
Well, we're a Google Home Assistant mini household, and the majority of the questions we ask are at 7 a.m. and saying, okay, Google, what's the weather today?
Right.
And it's usually wrong, but that might just be more of where I live in the city. But I think that the interesting thing here is that these tech companies probably also have to be nervous should these cases get litigated about what evidence they do or they don't have. The way that they've sort of described their technology working is that each of those devices in your home is a hot mic. They talk about how it's not recording unless there's an activated light on, but that's essentially the brain of the machine handling it. But the only way that it knows you said Alexa or Google or whatever other control word is if the microphone is on and listening at all times. And I'm sure that these companies don't want to get into the weeds on what they're doing with that data, the algorithms or technology that's processing what is the human speech to decide whether to activate over those milliseconds, and any sort of scrutiny of how that data is used. So I'm sure that these cases, when you have one where like this, where both sides, both the prosecution and the defense, are saying, yes, please get it out there, it might actually be a relief for Amazon, because now they don't have to get into a fight with engineers and computer programmers
Sure.
about really what the guts of their technology is.
By the way, Hollandale Beach, Florida, the home of Abe Lenkov.
Oh, really? Nice.
Father of one of our Legal Face-Off hosts. All right, let's keep rolling here, Dave.
And in Legal Face-Off podcast, we also cover celebrities. And this doesn't have to do with a song or a movie, but some celebrities were arrested for climate change protests.
Yeah, Tina, normally we cover celebrities who are arrested for doing stupid things. We actually passed over a couple of stories this week involving former Major League Baseball player Josh Hamilton, who was arrested for striking his teenage daughter. Also, Jordan Padalecki, star of Supernatural and the upcoming Texas Ranger reboot. We passed over those in favor of noted celebrity arrestee Jane Fonda, who is arrested for a whole other reason. She was arrested on Friday and actually put in jail this time. She's being arrested almost every week because she's protesting climate change issues at the Capitol. And she was actually put in jail overnight for the first time. And she's, what, 81
years old? She's 81
years old,
yeah.
And she has gotten other people to join her, like her co-star, Sam Waterston.
Who's 78.
Ironically, would put people in jail all the time.
Dun, 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 dun.
Ted Danson, Catherine Keener, and Roseanne Arquette. So the question for the group here is a couple things. It's easy for celebrities to get arrested because they're celebrities, and they go to jail for a night, and then they're released, and they get to go back, and, you know, the Beverly Hills mansion. But aren't celebrities treated differently, and therefore doesn't it make the arrest much less consequential than if a regular person was arrested? And secondly, does it have really any effect to these issues if celebrities are arrested? Tina, what do you think of those issues?
You know,
we all like Jane Fonda, and notably she was, you know, back in the day she would protest the Vietnam War and,
right.
and made a lot of headlines for visiting North Vietnam during that war.
You know, I think it's an interesting question you raise, because I do think that there is an argument that celebrities get treated better. And so what's the big deal if they get arrested, right? But I do think that at times and under certain circumstances, their reputation can get tarnished depending on who they are and what led to the arrest. And so I think they, in some ways, have a lot to lose. I mean, I do think that these celebrities are trying to make a statement. They're using their celebrity status to speak about something that they feel very passionate about. And I mean, Jane Fonda, as you said, has spent many years of her life as an activist. And, you know, God bless her. I mean, she moved to Washington, I think, in, at least in part, to engage in activism.
Mark, the Law Bulletin certainly picks up stories based on what you think your readers will engage in. Certainly this story got a ton more focus than it would be had her name been Jane Smith, right? So what are your feelings from the press perspective on covering stories where celebrities are using their position to gain some notoriety for an issue?
I think that this is sort of where that area where the public theater and politics and law sort of intersect here. And this is definitely far more in that first category. The end game for all of the actors and celebrities who do this is exactly what we're doing now. We're in a radio booth or a podcast booth talking about it. Whether the intended goal really gets there, I don't think we're going to get into the substance of climate change debate here, or whether it's really going to shift any minds of policymakers or the people who vote for them across the political spectrum. But really, if this is what they're going to try and do, it's sort of the modern equivalent of civil disobedience, knowing that there are cameras running and it's not necessarily disrupting a ton of lives. It's essentially being done specifically to get this headline. As far as what the Law Bulletin covers, we know our audience is a little bit more of the attorneys and judges and less of
we're not swayed
public.
By the so what are they wearing columns, right?
Right. So that's so there's definitely an element to that, and particularly like a topic like this that has political elements. It needs public support. It's not going to be won. They're not going to fix climate change by winning all these class action suits that come up. You need votes in the House and the Senate and a supportive president or even a supportive international community to do it. Stuff like this does get the conversation going maybe when the political end is at a standstill.
Anyone watching that show? The what's the name of the show? With Lily Tomlin?
Oh,
Jane Fonda?
Grace and Frank.
Yeah. You watch it?
Yeah, I do.
Good show?
Actually, what I was thinking is the article that you guys sent around actually said that she had started doing these protests in October and was going to stop by January.
Because she has to film.
I was hoping that meant that we were getting another season. Yeah. It's actually an interesting show. So she plays Grace and Lily Tomlin plays Frankie. And Frankie is more of the protesting, hippie, nothing commercial, like, maybe more of Jane Fonda than the character that she actually plays.
Role reversal.
Yeah.
All right.
Legal Face-Off today with politics, celebrities, technology, and now we're going to move on to a little bit of a business story because we're going to talk about Tesla CEO Elon Musk, who insults a lawyer during a bizarre deposition.
Yeah, Elon Musk, is famous for doing some wacky stuff. He was, he was shown during a podcast smoking marijuana, and he's made a lot of weird statements. But what got our attention was this deposition from June 1st that was just released, and there's a lot of back and forth. I read some highlights of it. It's about 440 pages, so I didn't read all of it. But there's some good back and forth between the Tesla CEO and the attorney who's questioning him. At one point, Musk asks if the attorney – he asks a lot of questions, and generally my role in depositions is – you are the deponent. You answer. You don't ask any questions. But this attorney lost control, it looks like, and he asked the attorney whether he drove a gas-powered car. And the attorney, Randall Barron, said he did. And Elon Musk said, why do you hate the environment? There was a lot of back and forth. Elon Musk called him a shameful person. He insulted him. He said, you seem like a very, very bad person, just a bad human being. I hope you come to regret your actions in the future. So I've represented some high-profile clients in the past, and you know, sometimes celebrities think that the rules of depositions are beyond them and they can do whatever they want. There's some famous – if you just Google some of these, there's some great depositions online, transcripts. Tina, what are your thoughts? Ever had a deposition with someone who was as difficult and insulting as Elon Musk?
No.
And how would you handle it if there was?
I would really try to, as his lawyer, try to get control over the situation as much as possible, because what it demonstrates, I mean, and just take Elon Musk out of it, when you have a client like that, when you're defending somebody in a deposition or what have you, you've got to really you know, that's why the preparation is so important, because you want to make sure not only do they know how to answer the questions, but that they don't start going off script, right? So it just doesn't look good, and it can be used by the other side in a way that is either predictable or unpredictable, and it could end up, you know, really hurting your case.
Yeah, Mark, you cover lots of depositions, lots of, you know, strange depositions. The way I remedy this is when someone goes sort of off the grid a couple ways, and you could always call the judge. That's pretty effective. But you could also just tell them we're going to end the deposition. And especially for someone like Elon Musk, who is clearly, you know, thinks of himself on a higher plane and probably hates being there, the best way to get them to comply is tell them, oh, you're gonna have to come back in a week or a month or whatever.
Well, I'm not an attorney, so I haven't had to have the pleasure of sitting in on a deposition. But when they cross the newsroom at the Law Bulletin, it's often because something happened and it's the pivotal evidence at a trial, or something goes off the rails and it ends up as a question on appeal, often because people either have no regard for the rules or decorum of it, or they don't understand it, or sometimes even with the best of intentions, the wrong question gets asked, the wrong answer comes out.
Yeah, I think the attorney actually did a pretty good job, from what I saw in the transcript, sort of keeping the volume at the right pace, because to your point, it could have gone off the rails. And Amy, what do you think about sort of generally demeanor of lawyers? We've covered that extensively on our show. Do you think the environment has gotten worse over the years of your practice? Do you think it's gotten better? Do you think attorneys are being, you know, more aggressive in questioning, or in terms of interacting with each other, more insulting? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I obviously have not worked with any high-profile folks like Elon Musk. Most of my clients are biotech, pharma, that sort of thing. With regards to the other side's attorneys, it really just depends on who you're up against. I've seen a lot of different types of attorneys in depositions, some of them more aggressive, some of them more loud. I haven't seen that to be particularly effective. I mean, with a deposition, what you're worried about is, you know, getting things that you can play at trial that hurt the case. I've been on the defending side of depositions with really loud and emotional and aggressive attorneys, and maybe this is just because my team at McDermott is really good at prepping witnesses for depositions. Maybe not, but they hasn't really been particularly effective at getting the necessary testimony that would be effective at trial. That being said, like I read a little bit of the testimony from Elon Musk, and was trying to think about how that bigger picture, how that would look at trial. And, you know, on one hand, he comes off as very passionate about his life's work, and maybe that is self-serving, but
All will be forgiven, yes, if he builds that tunnel to O'Hare, right? What happened with that?
If he finishes pretty much any of the projects he says, yeah, he can start. Yeah. Just any of them.
Then we'll forgive him.
I'm hoping for that tunnel, although I don't want to be the first person who tests it out.
That's 180 miles per hour, yeah, I believe, that tunnel, right?
Yep.
Yeah, this grab bag really has a lot of hot topics. And now we're going to move on to a little bit of sports. For those that have kids in sports, this is going to be very interesting for you, because ex-wrestlers argue that the WWE hid risks of head injuries. So now there's a lawsuit. Ex-wrestlers versus WWE.
So the story actually starts a while back. The WWE wrestlers, there were 67 of them, all of whom are retired, sued the WWE and its CEO, Vince McMahon, a couple of years ago, claiming that the WWE failed to protect the health of the wrestlers, and that they knew that being in the ring could end up with a number of different things, including CTE and concussions. So this case was actually dismissed last September by the Connecticut District Court. The basis for the dismissal was that many of the plaintiffs had stopped wrestling before the WWE could have been aware of these health risks, and that they really had only been focusing on it in the wake of the tragedy in 2007 of the former wrestler Chris Benoit, who ended up killing his wife and son, and then committing suicide right afterwards. So the wrestlers ended up appealing the case to the Second Circuit, and they argued earlier in the month that the statute of limitations actually didn't run, and that in fact the WWE, they're claiming, knew a lot more than they claimed to know about the long-term effects of wrestling. They claim that the WWE was actually researching the medical information on CTE back in the 1980s and 1990s. And that the Benoit situation, although the initial focus was on steroid abuse, became a CTE conversation months later. So this is an ongoing topic. We've discussed CTE a lot on Legal Face-Off in other contexts, and it's really just a sad situation, and it'll be interesting to see where this case goes.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you've got, you know, injuries involving concussions, obviously the argument is when do they manifest themselves, and that obviously affects legally the statute of limitations. So I think there's some merit there. And obviously, you know, as we learn more about the effects of concussion, I think that'll make it easier to bring these cases and harder to argue that the statute of limitations should bar them.
And continuing on with the sports topic, we have another story where umpire sues a player.
Yeah, so this is one that you don't see every day. Umpire Joe West is actually, I think, the most senior umpire that there is in the major leagues. And
Cowboy Joe West.
Yes, Cowboy Joe West. I've watched many a game over the years that he has been a part of. So he has actually sued retired catcher Paul LaDuca for defamation. He claims that earlier in the year, in the spring, he meaning LaDuca, had actually appeared on the Action Network where he was talking about his career and mentioned a number of things that West disagrees with. First of all, he claims that he was ejected 15 times during the course of his career, 8 or 9 of which he had attributed to Joe West ejecting him. But what's really at the crux of this case is the fact that LaDuca claims that when he was catching for a pitcher, Bill Wagner, in 2006-2007, he claims that Wagner told him that West was more gracious with the strike zone than he otherwise would have been because Wagner let umpire Joe West drive his 57 Chevy.
He bribed him, basically, right?
Yes.
Because Joe West is an antique car enthusiast.
Yes. And so as a result, after appearing on the show, Joe West sued LaDuca for defamation. And what I find interesting in this case is that I would think that he would go after Bill Wagner. You know, it's interesting. I just don't know. You know, this is really about what Bill Wagner purportedly said to LaDuca. I don't think that Joe West would be suing LaDuca over the comments on the ejections. I think it's really about him claiming that he's not ethically, you know, umpiring a game. So,
my God, keep it inside the lines. Amy, what are your thoughts on this lawsuit?
Yeah, Tina, I think it is surprising that he's not going after Wagner, but I think that Wagner also didn't say that on live radio or television or wherever the other guy said it. But yeah, no, I think it's a big deal. I actually used to be a professional soccer referee, and your judgment, your unbiased judgment, is how people accept your calls, accept your rulings. And to be the most senior umpire and to have somebody state that your judgment is not impartial is very harmful to your trade.
But wait, are we now, Mark, going to clog up the court system with lawsuits because you're questioning umpires at the pro level? Isn't that sort of part of the game?
It seems like it's something that the league is fully equipped to handle. I would imagine that just like anything else, that there is a code of ethics that they expect umpires to do. There's probably something in the rules about not taking any sort of action or benefit from players that might question their, you know, sort of a similar parallel to maybe judicial ethics codes in the legal industry, essentially calling the balls and strikes. You know, you have to be independent. But what's sort of silly about this too is that baseball has so many records and evidence and box scores that the anecdote he provided, from what it sounds like, is so doesn't even add up to the lines and everything. And Joe West is controversial enough with calls that if you're going to criticize the guy, at least stick to the stuff that people actually witnessed and don't, you know, embellish it. There's really no need. There's a very comprehensive record of bad calls that he's made.
Yeah, he's also one of these umps who loves to inject himself in the game and make these flamboyant out calls and strike calls. And, you know, last time I checked, no one's paying to go to a Major League Baseball game to watch the umpire. So
I remember reporting in Deadspin years ago, may it rest in peace, that that he has his own publicist, which is sort of an unusual thing for someone who's exactly like you said, he's supposed to be a background
character.
That is
his nickname. I don't need to have any umpire nicknames. And by the way, they're going to be replaced by machines like literally next season. So
there are people who say he's one of the best advertisements for robot umpires.
Exactly.
That's my thought, actually. Like we now have a giant box on the TV that tells us whether or not the umpire is right or wrong. Doesn't really matter.
Who needs it?
He's irrelevant now.
But no robot podcasters ever.
Never.
Can't exist. Absolutely. Not at all. Because then imagine what will we be doing? This is how we sign off on this edition of Legal Face-Off. Dr. Amy Mahan, is your website MWE.com?
Yep.
And for our editor of Chicago Daily Law Bulletin, do you have social media where people can follow you?
Sure. People can follow the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin on our website, chicagolawbulletin.com. We've also got social media. You can find us posting our articles every afternoon on LinkedIn and on Facebook and Twitter. Twitter is CDLB, our initials.
Must read for any lawyer every day. Absolutely.
This is The Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat going hand-to-hand.